and welcome to Connecting the Dots. I am your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with none other than Mr. Tom McDonald.
Hello.
Tom McDonald is, he writes for the National Catholic Register, and he's done a lot on the intersection between faith and technology. Used to write for Pathos. In fact, I think you can still go on Pathos and you can find his old blog there called God and the Machine.
Well, you can find me at thomaslmcdonald.com too, which won't give any traffic to Pathos.
Oh, well, okay. And that way you get everything. Okay.
Those heathens.
Okay. And so you can do that. And, of course, he is America's tallest Catholic radio co-host. So he's we have him here every Tuesday so that we can discuss arcana of various shapes and sizes, as well as, you know, whatever interests you. By the way, if you're out there in radio land listening and you want to join the conversation, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. You can also text us at that number, or you can tweet us at Breadbox Media. So, dude,
what's up?
I've been reading up and learning about some interesting stuff out there. I'm in the throes of
hysteria.
That too, but also. Also, I've been trying my hand at writing fiction.
Good.
And so, which I will freely confess, this is like all new for me. I've written very little fiction. For whatever reason, my work has never drawn me to it, and plus, I fear that I'm bad at it. And who likes to do things that they're bad at?
That's right.
So, however, following Chesterton's advice that a thing worth doing is worth doing badly, and that even a bad shot is dignified when he accepts a challenge to a duel, I thought I had an idea for a story, which I won't go into, of course, because I don't want to give too much away.
Sure.
But I want to, in the course of this story, I have a character who, among other things, has very deep roots in the Eastern and the African traditions of Christianity, which a lot of us are not super familiar with, being as how we're Westerners and we come out of the Latin tradition and... Most of that has got, even if you're Catholic, if, you know, who is it? Cardinal George once remarked that in America, everybody is a Calvinist, including all the Catholics.
It's true.
Well, we've got, you know, we are formed by our culture a great deal. And Catholicism tends to take on the tint of whatever culture it's situated in. It's sort of like spiritual tofu. It starts to taste like... Whatever it's, so you know, American Catholicism is a really different thing than Ethiopian Catholicism or Ethiopian Christianity, and so I don't know anything about Ethiopian Christianity, so I needed to know a little bit just so with fiction, the important thing to do is not so much to be accurate as to give your reader the sensation that you're accurate. So I remember there's a terrific fantasy writer named Tim Powers.
Sure.
And he tends to set he will have characters who get involved with real historical characters.
Right.
And so
like Stress of Her Regards was like Byron and Shelley, if I'm remembering correctly. Wasn't that
I forget. I haven't read Stress of Her Regard, but I read The Anubis Gates. And in that, what he will do, and I'm stealing from him in the work that I'm working on, what he'll do is he will drag in historical characters, and he'll find some weird, anomalous thing about them that will work into the story. And then he'll give some explanation for this weird thing about this character that's really true.
Right.
That turns out to somehow be involved in, like, you know, the bizarre occult action that's taking place in this story. So sure. In the Anubis Gates, for example, he drags Byron into the story. Lord Byron, the famous romantic poet, and at a time when Byron was known to be in Greece, Byron relates a story in one of his letters in which he says that he has friends who were living in London at the time who saw a guy who they could swear was Byron.
Mm-hmm.
In London at a time when he was known to be in Greece. And so what Powers does is he, like, comes up with an explanation for this. And it turns out that, like, Egyptian priests in the service of Anubis have conjured up a doppelganger from, you know, from their occult rituals. And this doppelganger of Byron that they made with a lock of his hair or something is, you know, is their slave to do whatever it is, whatever nefarious things they're up to in the story. And then at the end of the story, the doppelganger gets killed somehow or incinerated in some way so that, you know, all the evidence vanishes. And that's that's Power's explanation for why, you know,
right,
for why Byron's friend saw this guy that looked just like him wandering around in London, because it was this Egyptian occult doppelganger, and so he loves to do that. And but one of the things that I talked to him once when I was thinking about my story, and he said one of the things you have to be careful of is that just because something is historical doesn't mean people will believe it,
right.
So he talks about,
I can attest to that based on my where I work on at my end of the pool.
Yeah. So he says, for example, he was writing a story once that was set in the 1920s. And it turned out as he was researching the story that in American jazz culture, the word groovy was already being used in the 1920s. But he says, I can't have a character say groovy because no one would believe it.
Right. It would sound funny to the it would sound funny in the character's mouth to right. Our modern ears.
Right. Because we just groovy is a 1960s word. It doesn't matter that it was actually really used in the 20s. You can't have a character use the word because it would sound funny.
Right.
And so that's part of, you know, writing a story is you're casting a spell of believability. And that's all I'm really trying to do in this story. So I need to be able to believably suggest that my character is deeply immersed in this case, Ethiopian liturgical traditions and so forth. But at the same time, I can't bore my reader who really doesn't need or want a discourse on all of Ethiopian spirituality. All you have to do is just get across the idea of who this character is and that he's rooted in these things. And so I have spent a little bit of time learning about the Ethiopian church, which I found very fascinating. And
it is. There's a lot of interesting lore about it, too. Some curios about it.
Do tell. I'm interested.
Oh, you want them now? I figured I we'd get to them later. Well, I can give you one because I read a book about it and I don't believe it, okay. But that they hold the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah, that's true. That's one of the things that I learned about was the claim that they have the Ark of the Covenant and kept in a shrine in what used to be the capital of the area called Aksum, which is now a ruin. They also they're a form of spirituality that of Christianity that has been very heavily influenced by the Jewish tradition.
Yes, it is very Semitic. It's very ancient.
Right.
Ethiopian, like Coptics, from which they're connected to, like the Copts. It's a first century church. You know, it was established in the first century.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's very, very ancient, and it retained very Semitic properties to it, you know, and to its worship and to its iconography. And its canon of scripture is much larger and has much more, how would I describe them? Unusual Hebrew works in them, not just the Deuterocanonicals, but beyond that into the apocryphal stuff. Mm-hmm. That's really quite fascinating.
There's other fun stuff. There's one of the things that happens apparently, and of course, a lot of this is a bit murky. When they're talking about trying to trace their holy orders, there's this odd phenomenon that the church itself, its own tradition, traces its orders to basically a shipwreck where some Syrians wound up getting shipwrecked, and they wind up, because they're highly literate, this is the third century, they're highly literate, they wind up working in the court of the king, and because they're kind of the brainiacs, because they can read and write, and they know all this stuff, they wind up converting the court. And so they trace themselves to these Syrians, but then it's an African church, and the big cheeses in Africa are the Alexandrians. And so they would, like, you know, when they needed a bishop, they'd go to Alexandria and say, hey, can we have a bishop? And they give them a bishop, but they're not really interested in Alexandria because it was Syrians who started the church and formed them. So, things like this, which I find very interesting about how crazy the early church could be sometimes. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Tom McDonald. We're talking a little bit about the Ethiopian church, and we'll be back right after this.
Breadbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Greetings and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Tom McDonald, and we are talking a little bit about the early church. The part of what I'm thinking of along with this is the way in which the tradition gets handed down to us and what we think is important. I talked to, as it happens, the director of liturgy here in the Archdiocese of Seattle turns out to be, in addition to the director of liturgy, his like master's degree thesis was all about the Ethiopian church. And
it just happened.
What are the odds, right, that this guy would know this stuff? And so somebody pointed me to him, and we had just bumped into each other like a week or so ago. And he was familiar with my work. Nice guy, super knowledgeable. And, you know, part of it, I think, frankly, one of the nice things is when you go to a liturgy guy, the odds are that typically he doesn't have people like stop him in the street and say, oh, you can tell me about the Ethiopian.
No, he's been waiting for this moment for years.
So he's just like, here, let me just like unload this fire hydrant full of information on you, you know. So I Skyped him and then I recorded the conversation. So I've got it with me. And it was just a fire hydrant full of information that he knew about this. And one of the things that he points out is the way you do formation in the Ethiopian church is very Jewish. How did the apostles do formation? How did Jesus do formation? What you do is you go and live with this guy and you learn everything there is to know about his whole way of life. Right. That's how did Jesus form his apostles? They followed him around and listened to everything that he said and watched everything that he did.
Right.
And then they asked him a lot of stupid questions. and that was formation, you know. And so the idea even of a seminary, for example. Seminaries are real recent ideas in the Western Church. They're one way of attempting to form priests. They're not the only way the Christian tradition has ever pursued. And in the Ethiopian tradition, very much like in the Jewish tradition, what you did was you went out. In the early church, we have the phenomenon of desert fathers. Guys who just literally, they just went out in the desert and were just out there praying, fasting. Somebody would bring them communion. But they weren't out there to get away from it all. They were out there in order to be with God for the sake of the church. And people would go to them and would seek to be their disciples. That's what the Ethiopian tradition does too. You go and you find some guy, Abba so and so, and he accepts you as a disciple or not, and then you attach yourself to that guy and you learn everything there is to know from that guy.
When we look at Ethiopia, remember how they were. Where they trace their church back to is they're right there in Acts. They're described in Acts when Philip meets the Ethiopian eunuch and evangelizes him. And he's reading the scripture and he says, I don't understand this, basically. And then he explained it. And that's the encounter between the evangelist and the student to a certain degree. And that's where they, find their origin. Of their evangelization is right there in Acts, right there at the beginning, right at Pentecost, basically. Uh-huh. They consider themselves to be evangelized by, via the eunuch who was the eunuch of the queen.
Yeah, yeah.
Candace, correct? If I'm remembering.
It was actually pronounced Kandake.
Was it?
So it's a title. It's not a name.
Oh, it was. Okay. I didn't know that. Yeah. I thought it was Queen. Yep. Yeah, I thought it was Queen Candace of Ethiopia. Yeah, it was in my head. I had it that way.
Yeah. No.
Is that some of the new stuff you learned?
That was stuff I already knew. The new stuff that I was learning about was, for example, and this is also fairly typical for the East. So the liturgy in the Eastern Church is entirely sung. Everything is sung. The whole thing is chanted. There's at no point does anybody just like say something, and which also will fit into my story for various reasons, which I won't go into. But the liturgy is typically done, and this is something you see also in the Byzantine Church. When you receive the Eucharist, the elements of the Eucharist are commingled, so you have a little piece of bread. And with a little spoon of the precious blood.
In tincture. We used to be able to do it.
Yeah. And so it's spooned into your mouth.
Yeah.
Another tradition, what I thought was lovely, was after you receive communion, you cover your mouth because you're the tabernacle. In some places, once you've received communion, there's a period of time where people don't touch you because you're too holy to touch because you've received the body and blood of Christ. Those kinds of things I thought were lovely. And what went with it is a remark as well that in that tradition, the surest way of encountering the Word of God is through the living voice of the church. So through the living voice of the Abba who is teaching you, for example. And you see something like this reflected as well in the writings of Papias, for example. One of the apostolic fathers, Papias, is somebody whose life overlaps with that of the apostles. He's writing in the early second century, but he's writing about his experiences as a young man in which, among other things, what he did was he went around and anybody who had a scrap of information on the testimony that came from the apostles.
Right.
That's who he wanted to hear from. For him, it was the living voice. So it would be very much like somebody who today who has a passionate interest in the Kennedy administration. And so what would you do if you have a passionate interest in the Kennedy administration? Well, in addition to reading about stuff from people who were in the Kennedy administration, if you could go and talk to a guy who's still alive, who was in the Kennedy administration, and there's still those people are still around. It was only 50 years ago. You would go and do that. And that's what Papias wants to do. He wants to hear from eyewitnesses, if it's at all possible. And for a very good reason, just exactly the same thing today. Eyewitnesses are the people who saw what happened, and so you want to get it from the horse's mouth. And that approach to the tradition is something that you still see going on in the Ethiopian tradition. Now, obviously, there are no eyewitnesses to the life of Christ in the Ethiopian church today, but the conviction still is that you can interrogate a person. You can't interrogate a book.
Right.
Books just are there, and they just say what they say. And if it's not clear what it means, the book can't tell you what it meant. And a person can do that. And this is really, really different from us in the West. We have exactly the opposite approach to things. We tend to believe that books are the sure thing, that if something has gotten written down, then that means that it's somehow more real than something that's handed on to us by word of mouth. We have a deep conviction that every human testimony, especially testimony over time, has to be the telephone game, and it will inevitably be corrupted, and there's no trusting it. But books won't do that to you.
Well, we should mention the book, since we've talked about it here before.
The book
that people should read, which is by Richard Baucom.
Yeah,
Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, which kind of goes into a lot of this, and is a very important book.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you want to dig deeper into that kind of idea,
yeah, I highly recommend it. I'm writing a little piece on it right now. On this phenomenon, which he points out in particular, the importance of names in the New Testament, because names are the way that New Testament writers footnote their sources. And right. So it's not just a synagogue leader comes to Jesus. It's a synagogue leader named Jairus.
Right.
And that matters because to the audience that these guys are writing to, a synagogue leader who says that Jesus is okay.
right.
That's a big deal. But it also means that Jairus is part of the early Christian community. That's why we know this story.
Sure.
About the healing of his daughter is because he has told that story 1,000 times.
Right. The naming always struck me as the most interesting part when you come to people who don't believe in the testimony of the scriptures. And they just made those up. And I'm like, really? You really don't know anything about early literature, do you?
Well, yeah. And it's what's significant is names that are spoken and names that are left unspoken.
Sure.
So in the Synoptic Gospels, it was one of the disciples who cut off the ear of the high priest's slave. In John's Gospel, it's Peter. And we'll talk about why when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here with Tom McDonald, and we will be back right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
And welcome back to Connect the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here with Tom McDonald. We've been talking about the way in which the church, East and West, looks at tradition. In fact, of course, what happens in the early church right from the beginning is that tradition gets handed down both in written and in unwritten forms, just the way that tradition always has gotten handed down in really in any other human field. How do you become a great dancer? Well, you know what? Yes, there are books written on dance, but the main way that people have learned to become great dancers is they learn to become great dancers from great dancers.
Right.
So there is no patented, you know, Fred Astaire, Gene Kelly book that you go read and then you're Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly. What really happened was people studied these guys and watch what they did. And in the same way, you know, what the apostles were handing down ultimately was the first name by which Christianity is known is the way.
Right.
It's not the book.
Which sounds very interesting. Sounds very Eastern, I mean, doesn't it? You know,
it's very Eastern. Yeah.
It sounds like something, if you told that to a new age or today, they'd say, the way, man. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, right.
You know, but it was true. A description. It was a way to walk. You
right.
know?
And so
they actually tell you in the Bible where they were first called Christians, you know, I mean.
Hmm? Yeah. So. And it comes later and it's a kind of a nickname, you know, from the neighbors who called them Christianos.
Right.
Because you're those weirdos that followed that rabbi guy.
Right. And, rabbi, huh? Interesting.
Yeah.
Choice.
And, but so what gets handed down in the documents is handed down, on the one hand, it's the documents that are created by the early church, meaning the Gospels here, are written according to the canons, not of myth, but of historiography and biography. That's how these authors are writing, and that's every signal that they're sending in the text is we're giving you eyewitness material or material from people who were very close to eyewitnesses.
Right.
And so sometimes what's interesting is who gets named. So Mark alone is careful to mention not only Simon of Cyrene, who helped Jesus carry his cross, but he also, in passing, for no apparent reason to a modern reader, says Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus.
Right.
And it's just thrown into the text, and then the question has to be for anybody who's paying attention, who are Alexander and Rufus, and why should we care? Because they don't show up anywhere else in the gospel.
Right.
So who are those guys and why does Mark bother to mention them? Well, when you go to Paul's letter to the Romans in the 16th chapter, what you find is after Paul's finished his big discourse on everything that he wanted to say to the Romans, then at the very end, he includes a bunch of shout outs.
Right.
To everybody in the room, and should say hello to this guy and that guy and this woman and that other guy, you know, and tell this guy way to go and, you know, all this kind of stuff, right? And in the course of it, he tosses in greet Rufus.
Right.
And then what you discover, of course, is that Mark, according to universal early tradition, Mark is writing to the church at Rome.
Right.
Why does he mention Alexander and Rufus? Because the church at Rome knows Alexander and Rufus. Right. This is not a document that's recording something that happened 100 years ago, once upon a time. This is a document that's written by and for people who know the participants in this story.
Right.
And in many cases have already heard the participants in this story, heard their version of it. So Mark is writing, again, according to Papias, what he's doing is he's jotting down in written form a story that he's heard 50 million times from the guy that he traveled with named Simon Peter.
Right.
And Simon Peter winds up going to Rome. So the story that he's writing down for the Roman community is not a new thing that he's informing them of. It's getting down in print a story involving people who are actually members of the Roman Church, including Alexander and Rufus, and no doubt, of course, Simon of Cyrene until his death.
Sure.
So you really are looking at people capturing firsthand eyewitness testimony and then put it down in writing before the witnesses are getting old and dying. And that's one of the things that Bauckham points out is right. that for ancients, because you don't have big archives, you know, if you're lucky, you got to the library at Alexandria, but the library at Alexandria was already fallen to pieces by the time of Julius Caesar. You know, one of the great myths is that Christians destroyed the library at Alexandria. There's absolutely no foundation for that. It was gone. By the time it was supposedly destroyed by Christians. And the idea of a big library and a big archive like that was emphatically the exception, not the rule. In antiquity. So real history, as Bauckham says, real history was living history. It was history that was gotten from the horse's mouth by eyewitnesses, and best of all, if you could get it, by somebody who was himself a participant in the story. So Thucydides was in the Peloponnesian War.
Right.
That's why he writes it down, because he wants to get all this down on paper before all the living witnesses are dead. And the Gospels are written in the same way. They're written by people who, as Luke says, I'm getting this stuff from people who were from the beginning eyewitnesses of what has transpired among us. And that's really important, because it really ties together this notion, on the one hand, of tradition handed down in writing, but also tradition handed down by living witnesses,
right?
Which are really things that are characteristic of the Eastern and the Western traditions in Christianity.
Sure.
So,
the cross-cultural elements, too, which led to so much of our troubles, were those traditions trying to communicate in different languages and different traditions and different other things. Yeah. You know, as we were building up our theology and our Christology and everything, Ethiopians have a peculiar Christology in a couple of ways, I think, in the natures of Christ, which, you know, is, if you get into it that way, madness lies, because there's a lot of tiny little heresies you can get into just by saying the wrong word. But I think a lot of it, like Ethiopians, monophysitism is, you know, the idea of one, and I always stumble on that word because there's too many isms at the end. Jesus has one nature, but Miaphysitism, M-I-A instead of M-O-N-O, means that it has one nature in which, this is very confusing, in which the divine and the human nature are kind of fused. And the Ethiopians are Miaphysitists. But the interesting part is that both of those words stem from Greek, and they both mean the exact same thing. Mia and mono are both Greek roots for one. So basically, you've got a Greek terminology being used for two very different theologies about the nature of Christ, about Christology, that the words themselves are technically almost synonymous, but they actually have different meanings. Because mia and mono are like saying one and single, you know? So, and I always tripped over phytisms, phytisms, miaphytism and monophytism. You know, guys, see now we're diophysis. We're we believe, you know, obviously the Catholic model, the traditional Orthodox model of the natures of Christ is, you know, two natures in one person.
Yeah.
You know, but they were working out these heresies and trying to work them out across multiple languages with living people meeting and getting together and, you know, sometimes killing each other.
Right.
As they're getting into these debates and speaking, you know, Greek, Latin, you know, Hebrew in some cases, Ethiopic in some cases. Right. You know, there's a lot of strange cross currents that go on and pull these things apart.
Well, and you get there are other things going on as well. So, for example, the Ethiopian Church tended to preserve circumcision because they wanted to be as close to Jewish roots as possible. Now, by the way, you're completely free to do that as long as you don't think that it's salvific or somehow required.
Right.
You got things like that. You got, and there is in the Ethiopian tradition as well. There's a very strong tradition that's where the Ark of the Covenant wound up. And the idea was, you know, is something that comes up again and again in the Christian tradition as well, which is we must return to our roots.
Right.
That shows up a lot, right?
Right.
And so the way in which they chose to return to their roots was preserving certain Jewish cultural forms that they thought were important. And that's something that you discover as well, turning up in various parts. In the Eastern Church, for example, the idea of a Davidic monarch that's what determines most of the course of Eastern Christian history, is you're going to wind up with that in Byzantium. We'll continue talking about that as we return. We'll be back right after this. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here with Tom McDonald, and we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
Breadbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here with Tom McDonald. We've been talking a little bit about the Ethiopian church and kind of the different ways in which tradition gets handed down. One of the things that I mentioned before the break, time before last, was that one of the curious things in the gospel is not only when people are named, but also when people are left unnamed. So, for example, we know that there is a sinful woman in Luke chapter 7 who goes and anoints the feet of Jesus, but she's left unnamed. In another gospel, she's left unnamed, but Jesus says that this will always, wherever the gospel is preached, people will always remember what she's done. And then when you get to John's gospel, what John does is a chapter before he even gets around to telling the story of the anointing of the feet of Jesus, he says that he mentions Mary of Bethany, and then says, of course, this was the woman who anointed the feet of Jesus.
Right.
Now, if I were to introduce you as Tom McDonald, who everybody knows,
right,
is the guy that wrote God in the Machine.
Right.
But then I didn't get around to actually telling the story of how it was you came to write God in the Machine until like later on. Well, that means you're already really well known, and you're well known for one thing that you did. And what this boils down to is that there weren't like dozens of women running around ancient Judea constantly falling at Jesus' feet and trying to anoint his feet. There was one person who did this, and she was known for doing this. And it was the only thing that she was known for, practically, was this one thing. And so when Luke tells that story, he leaves her name out of that story. But everybody already knows her name. Why does he not mention it? Probably because she's still alive.
Right.
And you don't want to have document, you know, this is somebody who lives across the valley from Jerusalem, which is the source of all hostility to Jesus. So you don't want to like make her famous, right? In print where her name could be tracked down. But later on, once she's dead, Now you can tell this story. You can put this story in print because it's not going to affect her. And there's another thing that goes with that then. Peter's story. Repeatedly, we hear the story of the disciple in Gethsemane who attacked the servant of the high priest
right.
and cut his ear off. Why isn't Peter's story told with his name attached to it? Well, because, you know, this is not the sort of thing that you leave a paper trail for while Peter is still around. But once right. he's dead, and we know he's dead by the time John's gospel is written because John describes his death.
Right.
Now you can tell the story. And what's significant is not only is Peter's name mentioned in that story, but so is the name of the servant of the high priest, Malchus.
Right.
Why is his name left out as well? Well, probably because Malchus is an early Christian as well. Sure. We know.
He would have been a convert. If somebody glued your
yes,
ear glued back your, on,
right.
I would say, oh, okay, that's gone. Okay.
Exactly right. And we know, John tells us, that there are members of the arrest party who are really nervous about being there. That's why in that scene in John's gospel, when they come for him and he says, "Whom do you seek?" And they say, "Jesus the Nazarene." His reply to them is loaded. Right. His reply to them is, "I am he."
And they fall down.
And they fall down. Why? Because they're scared to death of him. They're there because they're under orders to go and get him, but they're terrified of him. And Pilate has the jitters about him, too. Right. Have nothing to do with this man because I have suffered.
Oh, well, it's even worse with Pilate because it's worse with Pilate because he was Roman and there was dreams involved. His wife said, "I had a dream." You know,
yeah,
and
like, exactly.
That was just a message from the gods right there.
Mm-hmm.
That was, you know, that was very, very significant.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you already have, you know, there's a lot of division in Jerusalem. This is one of the things that the church points out, is that, you know, if people who stupidly talk as though all Jews everywhere are to blame, you know, and they alone are to blame for the death of Jesus and the trial of Jesus. It's like, well, A, there was a huge amount of division about Jesus in Jerusalem, including among the party sent to arrest him. Right. And so you've got somebody like Malchus who gets his ear lopped off by Peter and then healed by Jesus the next moment, which, not surprisingly, as with Bartimaeus, what you've got then is somebody who becomes a believer. Well, when you're a slave, you kind of have to keep your head down.
Sure.
about things like that. Because if your master gets ticked off at you, he might not just lop off your ear, he might lop off your head.
Right.
And,
or sell you.
Or sell you. And so why is his name not mentioned in the other gospel? Well, because he's still alive. But now the name can be given. And so this use of names in the New Testament, I think, is very interesting. And that extends all the way, of course, to the names attached to the Gospels themselves. None of the Gospel authors ever say, "Hey, I'm Mark. I wrote this. I was a friend of, you know, all the bigwigs who were involved in this." He never does that. And yet, here's the thing. Again, going back to my Kennedy administration analogy, if you want to get information on the Kennedy administration, if you wanted to fake information on the Kennedy administration, you would write something under a pseudonym that's attached to somebody who's important.
Right.
You know, you'd have a Gospel of Peter. He's like the big guy, right?
And there are Gospels of Peter, and they're quite obviously fake.
Fake, right. So why do we have a Gospel of Mark at all? Mark is, like, not all that important, right? It's like getting a Gospel from the guy who was, like, the second-hand cook in the White House kitchen. Why is that guy's name attached to that Gospel? Well, because he wrote it, because Mark wrote it. And so we have that gospel because Mark is an eyewitness, But he's not somebody who's like super prominent in the early church. In fact, just the other day, we read the story in the liturgy about when Mark goes with Paul and Barnabas on a missionary trip, and they head out and they're gone for a while, and then Mark starts to feel homesick, and so he leaves. And it's like, this is one of the reasons that I find Mark so obviously believable as a gospel is because clearly this was really written by Mark. Nobody
right.
Nobody would ever say, I'm going to fake a gospel and I'm going to attribute it to this guy who chickened out.
Right. And it reads, it's a very, you know, homely book in a way. Its Greek is not particularly sophisticated. It's very vigorous. It seems like it's the shortest gospel, obviously, but it's got a very propulsive quality that feels like somebody trying to tell you a story in one sitting, you know?
Right. Yeah. And he's giving you, I'm convinced he's giving you the precy of what he's heard from Peter 50 million times.
And he says immediately over and over and over again.
Right. He says immediately, constantly. Jesus is always rushing from here to there.
Yeah.
And he includes things that I think are just beautifully, marvelously, naively put and therefore super believable to me, you know. So he says things like Jesus at the Transfiguration, Jesus's clothes became white, whiter than any laundry could make them. I think that's just adorable. You know? But and so when you read it, what comes across is obviously this is up close to the people who saw the events. And in some cases, this is so up close to people that saw the events that you're getting Mark's own eyewitness testimony.
Right.
So I think, you know, Mark alone mentions that one of the disciples, that they grabbed one of the disciples and he wriggled out of his clothes and ran off buck naked.
Right.
Why does Mark include that detail? Because that was Mark, man.
That's been the theory for a while, yeah, that he kind of put himself in there and that's didn't want to leave that one out. Hey, remember when they almost killed us and I ran away naked?
Yeah. And that's fairly typical of the kind of not information you would make up.
Right.
And include if you were lying kind of information. And one of the things that's striking, especially for those who convince themselves that the whole, you know, the belief in the deity of Jesus is something that grew up much later in the early church, that nobody thought Jesus was God in the early church, is Mark is the earliest gospel by, according to almost all modern biblical scholars. He's the primitive gospel. The other two gospels are, the synoptic gospels are borrowing from him and adding their own material as well. And it's from Mark that we hear the high priest asking Jesus, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? And in Mark's gospel, Jesus doesn't give an oblique, you have said it, kind of answer. He says, I am. Claiming to be God. That's what puts him to death. Hey, Tom, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. I want to thank you guys for listening out there in Radio Land. Ethan Bullen, thank you so much for your ever competent producership. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'll be back tomorrow with Rod Bennett. Till then, bye-bye.